support comes from Valley Medical Care, offering family health care in Juneau since 1982. Valley Medical Care, a proud sponsor of Public Radio in Juneau. Information at 586-2434. As Alaskans, we face important choices about how we produce and consume energy that runs our homes and businesses. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to promoting energy efficiency and educating the public of the benefits of stably priced, clean, and local renewable energy. More information at realaska.org. This message brought to you by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
And you're in tune with KTOO Juneau. It's just about 3 o'clock here on KTOO FM. I'm your host, Danny Peterson. We'll get an update on Perseverance Theater's production of The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry. We'll get a preview of Thursday's lecture, The History of Hydropower in Juneau, with guests Scott Willis and Jane Lindsay. Clarinetist Jose Frank Ballester and guitarist Robert Belinick will be here to highlight Thursday's Juneau Jazz and Classics Festival concert. And Jen LaRoe will be here to talk about the Housing First celebration that's happening this weekend. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more. Up next is National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A co-op in Alaska is working on a project using traditional Native culture to address suicide. The co-op is revitalizing the use of kayaks in northern waters. Founders are raising funds for the project to help prevent suicide among youth. KMBA's Jocelyn Estes has more.
A co-founder of the kayak co-op, Aleut David Karabelnikov, says learning how to create, build, and paddle their own kayaks will provide at-risk youth with lessons in science, engineering, technology, and math, and help set them on a healthy path.
And I really hope that this project will help to solve the suicide epidemic that we have in the Alaska Native community, and that Alaska Natives will be looked at in a positive light for the things that we have contributed to humanity. And the kayak being one of those technological marvels is really something that we can claim as our own and claim as something that makes us feel good, and the rest of the community, the larger community, respect our abilities and our capabilities for what we've done.
Karabelnikov says the after-school program will teach youth how to use computers and digital fabrication to manufacture custom kayaks. The kayak co-op fundraising campaign using the internet fundraising site Kickstarter.com ends Thursday. Reporting in Anchorage, Alaska, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The company that wants to build an open-pit iron ore mine in the Pinoki Range has applied for a license to explore there. They may also soon file an intent to mine with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Mike Simonson reports.
GTAC Mining Company spokesman Bob Seitz says they'll move in drill rigs as soon as the ground is dried in the area by the small towns of Morris and Anderson on the Ashland-Iron County line.
As everything this spring is going to be affected by the weather. So we'd like to start as soon as we can, but it's a matter of when you can safely get in there without doing any more damage. But all of the sites that have been selected are along existing disturbances.
Drill holes would be up to 1,000 feet deep over a 3.5-mile-long stretch. The first phase would get core samples by drilling 9 to 30 holes. DNR Waste Management Director Ann Coakley says they'll have 10 days to give GTAC an answer.
Technical staff will look over the submittal and make sure that it meets the new law, and they may do a site visit also. And that's to ensure that they're not drilling in environmentally sensitive areas such as wetlands.
The mine would be in the watershed of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, which has vigorously opposed the proposed mine. Bad River Chairman Mike Wiggins says he's alarmed that drill holes may soon be sunk in their ceded territory.
The notion of boring holes going down into pristine sensitive areas and into groundwater aquifers and are potentially going in that groundwater aquifers and things like that are definitely unsettling. They're in the headwaters of our nation.
Meanwhile, Bob Seitz says GTAC will soon file an intent to mine. That's a necessary step. A company has to file the intent to mine a year before applying for a mining permit. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson in Superior, Wisconsin.
The Goshute Tribe is working with a group of doctors to open a family health clinic in downtown Salt Lake City, Utah. The Salt Lake Tribune reports Sacred Circle Health Clinic would be the first tribally owned clinic outside a reservation in the state. The Goshute Reservation is located on the Utah-Nevada border. The Salt Lake City Clinic is being financed by a group of doctors who formerly worked with the Indian Health Service. On this day in 2012, musician Carlos Santana released the album Shapeshifter, dedicated to the world's indigenous people. He said the 13-song recording was created to encourage countries to honor their first people. Santana acknowledged the 2008 apology to Aboriginal people in Australia and the 2009 Native American apology resolution signed by President Obama. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And we're back on a Juno afternoon, and I'm here with my first guests today. They are Kenneth Ray and Yvette White. They're both actors in the play The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry. It's playing at Perseverance Theater. The remaining shows are May 16th through the 26th, and they're here to talk to me a little about the show. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. And could you describe to me a little bit about what the play is about? Unfortunately, I haven't gotten to see it yet, but what is it about?
The play is about so many things, but the simple answer is it's about the first black town in Oklahoma and the interactions between African Americans pre and post the Civil War and freedom, and also Native Americans post the Trail of Tears, and how they merged together to form this new kind of identity and the blending of the old way and the new way. And, yeah.
That's very interesting. And what's the style of the play? What can people expect? Is it a drama? Is it a... It must be a drama, surely, but...
You know, actually, it is a drama that has comedic elements.
Okay, that's what I was kind of wondering about.
And it's a play with music.
Okay.
Yes, Marcus Gottlieb writes epic plays. They are plays that are historically based. And also, he uses a lot of heightened language.
Uh-huh.
So you'll have a lot of ups and downs in this play.
And he's a poet, so a lot of the language is poetry.
Yeah.
So it's very... somewhat akin to August Wilson, that it has its own rhythm and
style
and structure.
Shakespeare as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's kind of this poetic kind of dialogue in there. That's great. Yeah. You mentioned the playwright. Had you been familiar with some of his previous work?
Yes.
Okay.
We've been hearing his name again a lot.
Yeah.
He's on the come up, as we would say. But I was fortunate enough to be a part of a reading at Howard University. Yvette and I are both alumni of Howard University in Washington, D.C., and there was an organization there was doing a fundraiser, and they used Marcus's play as a reading to raise money for the theater arts department there. So I was fortunate enough to be in one of his plays, and I actually saw the reading of The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry at the Kennedy Center a few years ago at the Irene Ryan, was it Kennedy Center's theater?
American College tour,
festival that they have,
yeah.
Where they bring schools from around the country to perform at the Kennedy Center. But for whatever reason, his play reading was there as well. So I actually got to see this play. So I've been familiar with it for years.
And also, we went together. There was a Black Playwrights Forum in D.C. That they invited Black playwrights from all over the country to come. And he actually read a snippet of this play there.
Uh-huh.
So that's where I believe I was first introduced to this piece.
Yeah, we both were.
Yeah.
And then we got to see the reading.
Yeah.
So you had both known each other in college in D.C.?
Yes.
Before, and then both of you auditioned for this play?
We actually lived together.
Oh, okay.
We're actually roommates in D.C.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
I auditioned first. Mm-hmm. I saw the notice online, and I remember the play, so I was really excited. And I've always wanted to go to Alaska, so I was like, I have to book this. I really wanted to. And I was begging Yvette to audition, and she would not do it. She didn't want to go to New York. And I was like, you gotta do it. And then I auditioned, and I didn't get it. Well, I thought I didn't get it, but I found out several months later that mm-hmm. I got it. And then maybe like a month later after that, they called you and was like, well, we're still looking for someone to play this part. And so then she finally went to New York and she got put on tape to audition.
So separately, we auditioned totally separately. He was already cast, and then I ended up getting cast as well.
That's really cool. That's kind of amazing, right? That you both are friends, roommates, and then you audition at separate times, kind of going on this adventure together.
Absolutely.
Is it both of your first time in Alaska?
Yes.
And my first time to the West Coast.
Wow, no kidding.
True story.
Wow, wow. Well, how do you like it?
It's beautiful.
Uh-huh.
Peaceful, calm. It's lovely. It's a nice vacation away from the East Coast.
Yes, we're not ready to go back in 2 weeks.
We like to stay.
We like the quiet. Well, a little bit. We don't want to move here, but
yeah,
we like to stay.
Yeah.
That's awesome, Matt. How was the rehearsal process and getting acclimated to the whole environment of Perseverance Theater and working there and everything?
Well, Perseverance, I will say, they have been extremely hospitable.
Yes.
And I would say that the arts community here in Juneau is so supportive. It's unlike anything I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
And I think it's probably very, very unique throughout the whole country.
Yes.
That the community houses the actors.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that the whole community kind of uplifts Perseverance. So it's just a great feeling when you go somewhere and say, I'm doing a show at Perseverance, and they're like, oh, what's the show? And
mm-hmm.
they offer you free things, and they're just really nice.
And just to add to that,
mm-hmm.
it was wonderful having host families, having the cast is very supportive, but also it helped this show because the show is about the Native culture.
Uh-huh.
So it's a special thing to have that show here in Alaska because our cast is pretty much divided in half, African Americans and Native Alaskans.
Oh,
and I believe half of the cast is actually Tlingit. So we were able to work together in the rehearsal process by fusing the cultures a lot. There was a lot of, what is it called in the beginning, where we did like the African Americans would present, let's say, music and rituals of our culture.
Uh-huh.
And the natives did the same thing, and the directors used that in order to create the sounds in this play.
And help us understand what it's like to really embrace
absolutely
another culture.
Absolutely. So it was wonderful, and this is a special place to have this show because it addresses both of these cultures.
That sounds really, really cool, and
mm-hmm.
I like how there's auditions happening in Alaska
mm-hmm.
for local people where it's being premiered at, and also in New York City where
absolutely
the East Coast where the playwright is from,
mm-hmm.
and have either of you been in a play premiere like this before, or it's like the first play that?
No, I've never been in a fully produced premiere. I've been in a lot of readings, but I've never been in a fully produced premiere. So this is very special. I'm very excited, honored.
Yes, absolutely.
Cool. How do you like it? Was it like nerve-wracking at first?
It's a unique process because typically the playwright is not in the room, so there's only kind of one person who's in charge, and it's the director. But having the playwright, the director, and the dramaturg, they all kind of weighed in on every element of the play.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And so it was challenging at some points, but it was also very helpful to say, I don't understand why you wrote this. I don't understand this. And you can just go ask Marcus and say, Marcus, can you explain this? And he can explain it and give you a history lesson on this character that you would have never gotten
absolutely
otherwise.
Because I believe he actually said this play is actually a part of a trilogy.
It is.
No kidding.
I believe the second part,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he has a play before and after it. So the questions and the holes that we needed filled, he was able to, him and the keys were both there to fill these questions for us about our characters.
So like, oh, in the first play, she da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what you find out in the third play is that he, so it was nice to have that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And who are the writer, who's the writer and the director and the dramaturge again? Could you just remind me?
The writer is Marcus Gartley. The
uh-huh.
director is Aaron Davidman.
Yes.
And I don't want to butcher her last name. Her first name is Nikisa.
And it's like Edamad?
Something like that.
But her name is Nikisa.
We call her Nikisa.
yes.
But yeah, she's the dramaturg.
What is a dramaturg? I'm kind of a novice about.
Every time they talk about this, they always use the example of if the playwright is the birth mother, The dramaturge is the actual midwife.
Oh, okay.
So she's the person who draws the historical facts, and she helps Marcus make sure everything is linear and make sure it makes sense and adds the details to the play and fleshes everything out for him. So he comes with the great ideas and says, this is the story, this is what I want the play to be about, and this is the historical basis. And she goes and researches and says, well, actually, this would have happened. And she helps make sure everything is correct and accurate for him.
Oh, okay. Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a very collaborative process. That was so neat how you're telling me the writer is there and getting bouncing back and forth with feedback. That must be just an experience unlike anything
Absolutely.
Else.
It's been great.
Well.
And tomorrow she's coming.
Oh, she is.
Yes. We have two events coming up connected with the play. Tomorrow night after the show, Nikisa and some of the cast members will be doing a talk back immediately following the show.
Uh-huh.
And so the audience will be free to ask any questions they have. And then on Saturday the 18th at the Juno Library downtown, Marcus and Nikisa will be there talking about playwriting and dramaturgy and creative collaboration. It's going to be at 1 p.m. and that's also free and open to the public as well.
Okay. Kenneth, Yvette, thank you so much for coming in. Thanks for mentioning those extra events.
Thank you.
For all the folks to hear. And the play is called The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry, and you can catch it. Still, it's playing in Juneau, May 16th through the 26th at Perseverance Theater. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 15th of May, 2013. It was on this day, 1817, the Asylum for the Relief of Persons Deprived of the Use of Their Reason was founded in Philadelphia by a group of Quakers. It was the first private mental health hospital in the United States. Until that time, mental illness was treated as criminal behavior, mentally ill people tied up, put in chains, isolated, even beaten. And the Quakers wanted to try a new type of care. In their founding statement, they said the hospital was intended to furnish such tender, sympathetic attention as may soothe their agitated minds and, under the divine blessing, facilitate their recovery. The asylum is still around today. It goes by the name Friends Hospital. It's the birthday of the writer Catherine Ann Porter, born in Indian Creek, Texas, 1890. Her mother died when she was two. The girl was raised by her grandmother. Porter wrote many years later, "Grandmother was by nature lavish. She loved leisure and calm. She loved luxury. She loved dress and adornment. She loved to sit and talk with friends or listen to music. She did not in the least like pinching or saving and mending and making things do. She told the girl stories of the affluent family she'd left behind in Kentucky, all the important and wealthy people in the family's history. Catherine Ann Porter got married at the age of 16, got divorced soon after, went to work writing for a newspaper in Fort Worth and then the Rocky Mountain News in Colorado, moved to Greenwich Village, started writing short stories. Her first book of short stories came out in 1930, Flowering Judas, and her one and only novel, Ship of Fools, in 1962. And it's the birthday of the man who wrote The Wizard of Oz, Lyman Frank Baum, born in Chittenango, New York, 1856. He was running a general store in Aberdeen, South Dakota, when he started writing fairy tales for children. Published his collection of Mother Goose stories, Mother Goose in Prose, in 1897, made some money off that, and in 1900 wrote The Wizard of Oz. He started telling the story to some neighborhood children and thought it was so good that he stopped in the middle of it to go start writing it down, all about Dorothy and Toto, the Scarecrow, the Lion, and the Tin Man. Here's a poem for today by James Whitcomb Riley, A Hint of Spring. 'Twas but a hint of spring, for still the atmosphere was sharp and chill, save where the genial sunshine smote the shoulders of my overcoat, and o'er the snow beneath my feet laid spectral fences down the street. My shadow, even, seemed to be elate with some new buoyancy, and bowed and bobbed in my advance with trippingest extravagance, and when the birds chirped out somewhere, it seemed to wheel with me and stare. Above, I heard a rasping stir, and on the roof the carpenter was perched and prodding rusty leaves from out the choked and dripping eaves, and someone hammering about was taking all the windows out. Old scraps of shingles fell before the noisy mansion's open door, and wrangling children raked the yard, and labored much, and laughed as hard, and fired the burning trash I smelt, and sniffed again, so good I felt. A Hint of Spring by James Whitcomb Riley. That's the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse, back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition, offering writing about finances, food, art, wine, and culture from around the world. More at wsj.com/celebrateweekend. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well. Do good work and keep in touch.
This is Dr. Russ Bowman. As a physician, I've seen the damage from secondhand smoke firsthand. For example, being exposed to secondhand smoke for 8 hours is like smoking a pack of cigarettes. That means kids, family members, and employees are all at increased risk for cancer, heart disease, and other life-threatening illnesses. There is no risk-free level of secondhand smoke exposure.
Brought to you by the Partnership for a Smoke-Free Southeast.
And we're back on a Juneau afternoon. You're listening to KTOO FM. I'm here with my next guests. They are Scott Willis of AELMP and Jane Lindsay of the City Museum. And they are here to talk about a talk going on tomorrow night, Thursday, May 6th at 7 p.m. at the museum, called History of Hydropower. Tickets are available, $10 for adults, $7 for senior. And thank you both for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
And Scott, could you tell me a little bit about what your talk tomorrow night is going to cover?
What we're going to talk about tomorrow night is a little bit about the history of hydro in Juneau. And that history of hydro really relates to the mining history in Juneau. You know, mining... Juneau is really sort of a mining town. Juneau is here because gold was discovered in the late 1800s, and it had and continues to have an influence on our community, maybe in ways that we don't fully understand. So we're going to explore the early mines' influence on the development of our hydro system.
Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating. Jane, I was wondering, are there going to be like historical artifacts at the museum, pictures or old equipment or stuff like that on display?
Sure, that's a good question. We actually have an assay lab exhibit that's part of our permanent exhibit in the General History Gallery. We have several murals. Recently, actually, AELMP sponsored an interactive hydro panel that shows you how hydro works in Juneau with some history about that. And we have a hands-on mining room in the back. It's stamp mill that you can turn to get an idea of how the mills worked, and also some history about the 1917 Treadwell cave-in.
Is there going to be a discussion at the end of the lecture, or is it just going to be a lecture? Is there going to be a Q&A at the end?
I plan to leave time for questions and comments whenever I give presentations like this. There are usually a lot of people in the audience that not only have questions, but also have some interesting fact that I didn't know about that they can share. So that's, I won't be surprised to hear some of those kinds of things after the talk also.
And when did the first hydroelectric station get built in Juneau?
As near as I can tell from my research, the Treadwell Mine built the first hydroelectric plant, and it came online in 1887 and provided light so that the miners, the folks in the mill, could continue to work into the night.
1887, you say?
That was a long time ago.
That is a long time ago. I was wondering about that. Is it because that's kind of around the same era that, I mean, cities were first getting electricity distributed. I mean, so was it like a really cutting edge thing to have electricity distributed in this way back then?
I've got a slide to show kind of a timeline of when Edison invented the incandescent light and mm-hmm. when his Pearl Street station in New York first lit up some of the streets in New York. And this wasn't one of the first, but the mines were early adopters of this technology. They could see the benefit and were able to use that to their advantage.
And where were the first ones? Were we near the beginning of this technology? Who did we borrow the idea from?
Well, this isn't the very first place that uh-huh. hydropower was used, but you could say it was one of the first. And you know, within about 10 years of power plants being installed in the lower 48 in some of the major cities, they started putting hydro plants in up here. And I haven't done a thorough study, but my guess is Juneau was one of the first smaller communities to get it. They were starting in the larger communities, mm-hmm. but because of the mining influence, the mines had needed power, and they had the money to invest in it. I think that allowed power development to come into Juneau earlier than it would have otherwise.
And Scott, doesn't it help, as you've mentioned before, just our geography? Lots of rain, lots of water, high elevations.
Sure. So we're talking about power development. You know, Edison's first power plants were coal-fired steam plants. But with the abundance of rain and elevation that we have here in Juneau, Juneau is ideal for hydro. It's what I call hydro heaven. And the mining companies recognized that they could build a hydro plant and not have to import coal or fuel oil to fuel their own power.
Did they have coal and fuel oil as a supplement back then, or was
they
it
did.
All hydro?
Yep, they did. We'll talk about that a little bit also.
Okay. And what percentage of Juneau's power today is produced by hydro?
Today, right this very minute, it's 100%.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, there's that's really unusual for a community to be 100% renewable energy. There's lots of places in the lower 48 that have goals to be 20% renewable by 2020 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we're already there. We only run our backup diesel generators if we have to take the Snedisham line down for maintenance or if there's an outage or something. So throughout the year, we're 98 or 99% hydro. I tell people we're 100% hydro 99% of the time.
That is pretty cool. It's pretty cool how this, you know, renewable technology, I mean, a lot of people think of it as like a 21st century phenomenon or 21st century trend or new way of thinking, but it's kind of funny how this whole city has been sort of powered by hydro since the beginning of electrically powered cities.
That's one thing we'll be bringing out in our presentation tomorrow.
What are some of the challenges of using hydro? I know it's renewable, but there must be some challenges along with it too.
Sure. You know, if you run a coal-fired power plant, one of the important things is to make sure you've got train cars full of coal continuously coming so that you'll have fuel for your power plant. With a hydro system, we're generating electricity with rainfall and snow melt. And so we're sort of relying on Mother Nature for our fuel supply. And sometimes she does a good job of delivering it when we need it, and sometimes she doesn't. And so if we go through a dry stretch, we may run a little short of hydro. So that's really the challenge is having an unpredictable supply and wanting to use that as efficiently as we can.
Is there new technology that has a workaround for that kind of thing? Because I know it's like that seems to be a kind of a problem with a lot of renewable energy, like solar energy. The sun doesn't always shine, so what are you going to do when it's dark out? Is there technology being developed right now to help that?
Not so much. You know, we get rain and snow when we get it, and we're at Mother Nature's mercy in that respect. Where we see the technology happening is in better forecasting of this season's snowfall and weather, and better computer programs to help us sort of optimize the way we use that.
All right. Well, that sounds great. And Where can people go to buy tickets for this talk?
Sure. You can give us a call at 586-3572. You can show up at the door tomorrow. We'll open the doors at 6:30. The lecture will begin at 7, and it's at the museum, which is 4th and Main Street. And just to keep in mind that Main Street is pretty torn up right now, so you might want to come a little early to make sure you've got parking options so you can get up to the museum, and it's well worth it.
All right. Well, Scott and Jane, thank you very much for coming in. Is there anything else you want to add to let people know about while you're here?
We're going to show a lot. Coming to hear an engineer talk about hydroelectric power may not sound very interesting, but we're going to show lots of cool old photos, and that'll be fun.
All right. Excellent. Thank you both very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Well, you can't get power from Smitty's Jam unless you build a great big dam. Well, you can't get power from Smitty's Jam unless you build a great big dam. Ain't gonna blow me down no more. 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 Well, a dam's gotta have a big power line so folks in town can plug in fine. Well, the dam's gotta have a big power line so folks in town can plug in fine. Ain't gonna throw me down no more. Ain't gonna blow me down no more. Ain't gonna blow me down no more. Go blow me down no more. But a line can't rise all the way to town, cause the Tahu wind might blow it down. But a line can't run all the way to town, cause the Tahu wind might blow it down. Is a mighty fine tool, but it costs so much, they'll turn you blue. Well, a submarine cable is a mighty fine tool, but it costs so much, they'll turn you blue. Ain't gonna blow me down no more. Ain't gonna blow me down no more. Ain't gonna blow me down no more.
I'm a daughter. My mom has lots of support. Unfortunately, some older Alaskans and people with severe disabilities don't have anyone to protect them. Harm comes in many forms.
If you see an acquaintance, neighbor, or family member being harmed, call Adult Protective Services, 800-478-9996. Message brought to you by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
All right, and we're back on a Juneau afternoon. I'm your host, Danny, and you're listening to KTOO-FM in Juneau. Special thanks to that song about Snettisham, written by Pat Henry and Riley Woodford. My next guests are also musicians. They're playing for Juno Jazz and Classics. Would you mind both introducing yourselves?
Yeah, my name is Jose Frank Ballester.
And the other half, Robert Belinich.
All right, and you are both performing tomorrow at Chapel by the Lake at 7:30, and the show is called Mendelssohn and More. And what are some of the pieces that you're going to be playing? What's the more of that of that performance?
Jose is pointing to me, so I guess I'll cover that. I'll try. The more, we'll see. I will play something solo, a few pieces for classical guitar, Latin American pieces.
Okay.
There's another piece that we're going to work on. A surprise piece that I don't know if it's in the, is it in the
it's
program?
Not.
It's not, right?
I looked it up online earlier and said one of them said Gershwin. Does that sound right?
I don't know.
That's
gonna
okay.
It's going to be a surprise piece. We're just going to leave it at that.
I didn't mean to catch you on the spot there. There's a lot of different pieces.
Maybe Mendelssohn.
and some, but all of the music that we play, I mean, the several programs that we did here, everything is very us. I think we enjoy doing all of the music that we played. It's very Latin American based. Some of it is from Spain, from Jose's country, but we enjoy really everything that we did, and we hope tomorrow, you know, people will enjoy it too.
And have you done shows, other shows this season for Juno Jazz and Classics as well?
Yes. We've been here the whole week. So we've been playing for schools. We did a couple of shows as well.
Uh-huh.
And it's been a great experience to be here.
That's awesome. Did you get to talk to the school kids and talk to them about music or anything like
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Every day, that's what we do.
Yeah.
And they've been fantastic. They've been very appreciative.
Uh-huh.
And they really wanted to learn from the very beginning. And they really reacted very well to music. So that's it's phenomenal.
Uh-huh. Was that just at the JDHS auditorium or was
No,
it,
we uh-huh. actually went to most of the schools around the area.
Probably. We covered all the schools in the area.
Yeah, probably.
And all ages, like middle school, grade school? Okay.
That's correct.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. And how long have both of you been playing music? Jose, how long have you been playing music?
Well, I'm 31 years old now, and I started playing clarinet when I was 9 years old.
Okay.
So it's been a while.
And Robert, how long have you been playing guitar?
And, I've been playing guitar since I was 12,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I started at the local school. But before that, I was in a band, and I played drums. I loved drums, and that was sort of the thing that I did before that.
Oh, that's interesting. How was the transition from percussion to guitar?
Strange. But, you know, to be honest, now, these days, it helped me tremendously. You know, that beat mm-hmm. and all that, you have it in your blood, and it never leaves you somehow, you know. And I noticed that it helped me later, like while actually studying guitar.
And why did you finally land on guitar?
Oh, just many weird coincidences for many reasons, but to be honest, it was a sort of I never really wanted to play the guitar as I was young,
mm-hmm.
but it just in a local school, they had a couple of instruments, and out of those, I picked guitar by chance, and sort of fell in love later, not at first sight.
And why did you end up playing the clarinet, Jose? Could you tell me about that?
I ended up playing clarinet because many members of my family are clarinet players. Even my great-grandfather was a clarinet player. And because of that, my family decided that I should start with percussion.
You both started with percussion.
Because there were many clarinet players. So they gave me percussion, and I didn't enjoy that at all.
Really?
I didn't want to play percussion, and so I made my percussion teacher crazy.
Cool.
I played every day, like, everything that he told me, like, in the wrong way. And to one point that he called my dad and said, you know, I cannot teach your son anymore. I don't think he has coordination. He mentioned coordination. He has no coordination, so he should do other stuff. So you told that to my father when my family, they're all musicians. So my father was, like, devastated on the car, and he said, Jose, what I'm going to do with you? And they say, Dad, give me a clarinet. So he did.
Wow.
And the funny thing is that, like, a bunch of years later, I came back to Spain to play with an orchestra.
Uh-huh.
And I'm playing this concerto where he has a big percussion solo. It's not a drum solo, like Nielsen concerto. And then the first rehearsal, I'm looking at the percussionist, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is my old teacher, percussion teacher, the one thing I had no coordination. So at the end, like, members of the orchestra were coming backstage to say hi, and he just came, and he's like, Jose, you remember who I am? And it's like, of course, you're Professor Santiago. And he's like, can I ask you something? What the heck happened to you? So I told him, and he was like, oh, you shouldn't have told me before. I was like, I was a baby, I was a kid, so that's what I knew how to do. I never told you that story, Robert.
No, yeah, I'm just... Wow.
So we both... And then my sister started with clarinet. And then she switched to percussion, you see?
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Well, you just never know.
Yeah,
you never know. It's a funny thing with percussion, right, Robert?
Yeah, with percussionists, you never know.
Never know.
You never know.
You could kind of go anywhere from percussion.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah. But it's a base of everything, you know, the rhythm, so... Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you guys should start a percussion band.
We are considering a new name for our duo.
And you have to say that our audiences, our younger audiences,
have mentioned that
suggested
to you.
a new name.
We should be the Juno Jacks.
The Juno Jacks.
Yes.
The Juno Jacks. I think it was a great name.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
thank you
for
your younger audiences and listeners. Yeah, we thank them for this idea.
Yeah.
I don't know. You have to ask them.
Okay.
It was their suggestion on one of those master classes, and we did at schools. It's like, hey, there they are, the Juno Jacks.
They confuse jazz, Juno Jazz and classes with jazz. So they're the Juno Jacks. I'm like, oh, I like that. I like that. We just have to write our management. They will have a heart attack. They hear about that. Okay, no. Just kidding.
How long have the two of you been playing together?
We've been playing together very recently, actually.
Uh-huh.
We started in October playing together, and we only did a couple of concerts. So it's a new thing for us to, like, Robert and I, we both have solo careers.
Uh-huh.
So we are always by our own doing concerts as solo or with orchestra. And I started a group called Mixed, where I combine a series of a bunch of musicians together with a couple of touring programs. So this year we have two touring programs. One is with violin, piano, clarinet, and the other one is with guitar and clarinet. So that's what we are doing right now. And I have to say, it's been incredible playing with Robert. Like, none of the music that we are playing was written originally for clarinet and guitar. So Robert did the arrangements. He really worked really hard, and it's working very well, and it's like a party. Like, our program usually is called Fiesta Party, and
that's
it really
like
feels
party,
like
yeah.
that.
Mm.
Uh-huh.
We just get together and enjoy.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yes.
And, guitar, it seems like an unusual instrument for, like, classical music. I mean, I'm not much of a music expert, but,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think of classical guitar as one thing, kind of classical music as something else. And is there a nuance
connection?
To kind of try to adapt that and, you know?
Yes. Classical guitar by itself, it's a relatively new thing. It was started in, like, 20th century, so 19...
When did you start? When it started on the 20th century?
It was by when Segovia, Andres Segovia started playing, the great Spanish guitarist, started playing Okay. Classical music on the classical guitar. Or no, even actually on the flamenco guitar version. And then that's considered like the time of the classical guitar. Unofficial.
They were composers that they composed for guitar before, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like
right.
Which ones? Like
mainly
Paganini,
Spanish.
Right? Paganini?
Yeah, yeah. But those were, it was like the old era. You know, like the modern classical guitar that we consider classical guitar is like from Segovia and on. And then before that you have like romantic guitar and baroque guitar.
What are the different kind of guitars?
Different guitars, yeah. They're actually different instruments. So they're like smaller and they have got strings and completely, completely different, right? But the guitar that I play, that we play, that we know today, that's like considered from his
So
his
in
time.
Spain we have this famous guitar composer, like all guitar composer, and his name was Tárrega, Francisco Tárrega. Was he from the modern or the old?
He is considered modern.
Modern.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, a lot of his repertoire is played today, like in competitions, and people know this music, yeah, a lot.
And
we do a lot of arrangements, you know, we do arrange a lot and combine, and now, for instance, new composers are writing a lot of guitar concertos, classical guitar concertos that we perform with orchestras, and we adapt guitar as much as we can.
And Dania, important thing is that many of the music schools around Europe and even United States now are including guitar as a part of their curriculum.
Uh-huh.
Like I studied in this famous school in Philadelphia, the Curtis Institute of Music, and when I was studying there, they didn't have any guitar. And now since a couple of years ago, they included guitar as part of the curriculum. So I don't think guitar is trying to get together with classical music. I think it's part of classical music.
It is,
okay.
It is. Yeah.
Yes.
It's like a new wave of classical music, and now it's just part of the curriculum. Well, that's great, and it sounds like you both are doing really great things with music. And they're going to have a show tomorrow, and it is at Chapel by the Lake at 7:30 p.m. Jose and Robert, thank you both for coming on.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks.
Everyone who made K2 Spring Auction a success. If you missed the live auction, there are still some wonderful items and experiences available to bid on. Please check our website at k2.org for details. We are accepting bids until Monday, May 20th at 5 p.m. Support public radio and bid at k2.org.
And we're back on a Juno afternoon. The song we just played was from our previous guest, Jose Franz Ballester, and he is playing along with Robert Belinick for Juno Jazz and Classics tomorrow, 7:30. Our next guest is Jen LaRoe. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you are here with Housing First, Inc. in Juno.
That's right.
And, first of all, thank you for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I was just having a conversation with you about Housing First, and I was asking you about what is Housing First, and because it's kind of a national model, but there's something in Juno called Housing First, Inc., and what is Housing First, Inc. in Juno?
Well, Housing First, Inc. is a small nonprofit that's been around for 20 years, just over 20 years. Our mission has been to provide affordable housing to Juno people and especially low-income folks. We have two buildings that we developed and built with loans and grants. One of them is called Strassbaugh Apartments up on Gastineau Ave, and the other one is called Hillview Apartments over on Douglas. And they're just small, well-maintained apartments that we have rented and managed by Powell Realty. So that's what Housing First has been doing for the last 20 years, building and managing. And then we also offered a down payment assistance program to help low-income folks get into their own homes. We did that for several years.
And how did the nonprofit originally come together?
Well, there was a group of just local concerned citizens. Believe it or not, this housing crisis has been going on for well over 20 years. And 20 years ago, some of the citizens, concerned citizens, just decided to take some steps to make a change and make a difference. And so they formed a nonprofit. It was started, I believe, mostly by some people who were involved with the Northern Light Church, because that's where they held their original meetings. And that is where we're going to hold a celebration of 20 years and our transition into a merger on Saturday, the 18th. And we'd like to welcome anybody who was involved with Housing First over the last 20 years. There's at least 100 people that I collected names from old papers and stuff around the office. So.
And what is Housing First merging with?
We are currently finalizing a merger with St. Vincent de Paul Society in Juno. As most people know, they are very involved in housing for low income and serving the poor in lots of other ways also. So it was a good match for us.
Excellent. So two nonprofits merging into one. Is there actually going to be housing? Are there actual housing areas in that sort of building block of St. Vincent de Paul's?
Yes, St. Vincent de Paul has a thrift store, which actually provides a lot of the income that helps support people who can't afford to pay their rents. And also, they also provide monetary assistance to folks at times of need. And that's generated from, you know, local citizens supporting St. Vincent de Paul thrift store. It directly goes back to help those members of the community who really need help. And so the housing, there is a senior housing in that same block there called Smith Hall. And then we are actually in the process of applying for the state grant that Alaska State Housing Authority just provided an opportunity for Juneau to receive tax credits that will help build new affordable housing in Juneau. So we have an application in. We'll find out on May 20th if we are going to get funded by this program. If we don't, someone in Juneau will, which is good news for Juneau.
And where is this new affordable housing going to be put? I guess it depends on
right. It depends on who gets it. If St. Vincent de Paul wins the award, it will be across the street from Smith Hall. We already own a piece of property there that was donated years ago, and so that would be the site. It's right across the street there, so it's really perfect situation for us.
Sort of that Airport Boulevard type of behind the Nugget Mall area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do you Housing First Inc. also own Smith Hall?
No, Housing First only owns the two properties that I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But now with the merger, St. Vincent de Paul will become the owners. We're merging together and basically maintaining the identity of St. Vincent de Paul, and Housing First is just kind of being absorbed by St. Vincent de Paul. So our assets will become their assets as soon as we get everything finalized. But both boards have signed off, and everybody's moving forward. We just have a couple details to finalize.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
And what all is happening at this 20th anniversary celebration? And is it open to the public? And that?
Yes, it is open to the public. It's going to be from 4 to 6. And mostly we're just wanting to welcome people who were involved with Housing First to maybe share stories and share refreshments and just there'll probably be a little bit of displays of, you know, past articles and maybe some blueprints from the past structures that we had built. So it's basically just, to recognize that Housing First was run by the efforts of the community of Juneau. And so we want to just recognize that as we get absorbed into a larger entity.
Excellent. And Housing First, Inc. Development areas are there in Juneau right now?
There are two buildings that we have developed, and then there were a couple out on Delta Drive. There were a couple home ownership units that Housing First built in the 80s, or actually it was in the early 90s, that were built and then sold to low-income families on Delta Drive.
And is this organization has sort of been helping people stay off the street and that and get housing, get shelter?
Well, we haven't really been too involved in the social service aspect, if that's what you're asking, about kind of working directly with folks. We just have been in the business of providing the housing itself.
Sure.
Yeah.
More of like an indirect way, or just getting people who can't afford it, but they just can't afford the more expensive housing.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. It's kind of a bridge between those two.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people need to rely on Section 8 vouchers, which provides subsidy for their rent costs.
Uh-huh.
And so that has been a way that we've helped provide the housing. If you talk to any social service agencies in Juneau and ask them what the number one issue for their clients are, most likely they'll say lack of housing. And it's not just lack of affordable housing. There's really a lack of housing across the board in Juneau for all income brackets. And so those that are low income, are put to the bottom of the list. And you know, rents are then held pretty high because there is such a demand. So it's a real challenge for folks in this income bracket to find anything that is suitable.
Uh-huh. Well, Jane, congratulations on the merger. And I hope you have a great time at the 20th anniversary party. It's happening this Saturday at 4 p.m., 6 p.m. If you know about Housing First Incorporated or have been involved with St. Vincent de Paul, you want to come stop by.
It's at the Northern Light Church.
It's at the Northern Light Church this Saturday, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Jean, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
A press conference with U.S. Surgeon General Richard Carmona on the health hazards from exposure to secondhand smoke.
Secondhand smoke exposure causes heart disease and lung cancer in adults and sudden infant death syndrome and respiratory problems in children.
The debate is over.
Secondhand smoke causes tens of thousands of heart disease deaths each year among U.S. non-smokers.
Brought to you by the Partnership for a Smoke-Free Southeast.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also broadcast on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay area, tuned to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269 AO 101.7. Gustavus, K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serving Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at www.ktoo.org.